Good morning, Steve Dale's Pet World on WGN. Dr. Sally Haddock is here. She is the board president of the North American Veterinary Community. She's from New York City, where she was a veterinarian for many years in a place that was underserved. We will talk about that. We'll talk about veterinary medicine today, and we'll talk about what the heck is the North American Veterinary Community. Dr. Haddock, I am so honored and so excited to speak with you, and congratulations on your board presidency, which is one of many, many honors you've received in your career.
Well, thank you, Steve. Thank you for that great introduction, and it's great to be here with you. I'm really excited about talking about changes in veterinary medicine. I'm passionate about veterinary medicine. You know, I've been part of this profession for 45 years, and I've seen incredible advances in veterinary medicine and science, and it's transformed the profession, and we've helped animals of all kinds live longer, healthier, and better quality lives. In fact, I don't know if you know, did you know the lifespan of a dog has doubled over the last 40 years?
Yeah, so that's the good news. And our cats, by the way, let's not forget them. They are living far...
No, I was going to bring that up too.
Yeah, far longer than ever before, in part because we're keeping them indoors is greatly, and that's a huge part of the answer. But let's back it up a couple of steps. I said you are the president of the board of the North American Veterinary Community. That sounds very official, and that like you're in control of all of us. What is the North American Veterinary Community?
Well, I'm not in control of anybody. The North American Veterinary Community is a fantastic organization, and they focus on the importance of veterinary education for the whole veterinary healthcare team. So that's not just vets. That includes technicians, practice managers, and as we call them now, CSRs, client service representatives, where we can all get up-to-date information and help us to be more efficient and do better jobs with our animals. So they recently hosted VMX, which is the world's largest expo and educational event, where veterinarians have come from all over the world. Believe it or not, we had 86 countries representative. So it was really amazing. I went to one of the informative lectures that I attended. It was on cognitive dysfunction. Unfortunately, I recently euthanized our beloved 14-year-old yellow lab, Barley, who had dementia as well as other medical issues. But I learned in this lecture that in humans, it's been shown that losing your vision and losing your hearing right. can cause the progression of dementia. And I never realized that, and they have even shown this to be true in dogs. So realizing this fact really helped me to understand my own dog's progression with this horrible disease.
Yeah, we have a 17-year-old dog, and I work hard at, you know, in a little Chihuahua Terrier, and we work hard at trying to make some adjustments in her environment on a daily basis to enrich her life. And yeah, she doesn't hear as well as she used to, and it's not only selective hearing. I know that, and she she walks into walls on occasion. So I understand that. You know, what has changed, I think, more than anything else over the years might be the intensity of the human-animal bond combined simply with the number of pets we have, which I know is far more than even a couple of years ago, let alone when you began practicing veterinary medicine. Do you find that there is a more intense, that's the best word I can think of, human-animal bond than there's ever been?
Absolutely. Over the years, I've watched the relationships with our pets change. The pets have become part of our families. They even sleep in our beds. And it's been shown that pets are really beneficial to owners, too, like it lowers your blood pressure, keeps you more active and healthier. I mean, I would definitely say that people and their pets are closer than they've ever been, for sure.
You know, to me, I have certain people on speed dial, right? Beside my wife and some close relatives of mine, there are two other very important people that need to be on speed dial. One is my computer guy, and the other the other is my veterinarian.
Yes, and absolutely.
Yeah, so I want to talk about that a little bit, because there are more veterinary clinics. It has been suggested by some that, and many people don't see a veterinarian even once a year, particularly people who happen to have a cat. Where I am of the feeling that twice a year for life is really important, not only for senior pets, but not only for puppies or kittens, but for all of our pets. Maybe not a leopard gecko, but for the most part, it's, for me anyway, twice a year, because preventive care, we know so much more about today than ever before.
I thoroughly agree with you. However, if it's a macaw who might live to 50 or 60 years, you might be able to get by with every few years. But no, it's so, so important. And it's important to have a baseline of blood work and know what your pet is like when it's younger, so you can compare and see the changes, and you'll be able to pick up on diseases faster. And people don't realize that, I don't think. And also, if you pick up on something quicker, we can nip it in the bud before it blows out of proportion and you end up spending all kinds of money and putting the pets through so much. So, yes, veterinary care, routine veterinary care is important. And preventatives are very, very important. You know, this is something that has changed in the years since I've been a veterinarian. In the early ages of me being a veterinarian, our heartworm preventative for dogs were daily pills. And, you know, we thought that was great that we had heartworm preventative. Well, now heartworm preventative is a once-a-month pill. They even have injections that could last 6 or 12 months. But now they have combination products that are not only heartworm preventative, but flea tick preventative. And that is so, so important. You know, I live up here now in Vermont in tick country, and I am neurotic about my pets, and I don't want them to get Lyme disease or Ehrlichia anaplasmosis, all the things that ticks spread. And I even not only do the once-a-month combination product, but I also do middle of the month a topical that does not go systemic, and it repels ticks. It's called Vector. I put it in multiple places on the skin because I want that reassurance that my pets aren't going to get sick. And in the long run, preventatives help people save money because you don't have to rush your pets to the vet. They don't have to get sick. You don't have to run all the testing and everything. So it's easier on your pocketbook if you just keep them on preventatives year-round.
I totally agree with everything you said. But when you do go to the vet, finding that veterinarian that's right for you and having a lifetime relationship, I think makes all the difference in the world. I want to talk about that. And I also want to talk about continuing education that veterinarians receive. How the heck do you keep up? And I don't think that's true. I don't think that people even know how much continuing education your average veterinarian or technician has voluntarily beyond what the laws say that most professionals do. We'll talk about all that when we come back with Dr. Sally Haddock on WGN. She is with the North American Veterinary Community. Dr. Sally Haddock is here. She is the board president. But that is not the only reason why I wanted to talk to you. I wanted to talk to you because you have a history. I mean, veterinary medicine is not inexpensive, and you have a history of helping those, finding a way to do that. Yet, fair enough, you should make a living for yourself. For people who don't necessarily have the resources in a community, as opposed to another community where people are more likely to have resources. And now, as I said, with the cost going up of everything, including veterinary medicine. So you have found a way to do that. Now, today, with more pet owners or pet parents, I should say, than ever before, we have a greater range, which is good, of people who have pets. But the profession is struggling a little bit. How do we find a way to serve everyone equally? Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah. You know, there are a lot of different groups that are reaching out to help people in that way. And I mean, I was fortunate to live in New York City, and we had an organization called New York Save, which is saving animals in veterinary emergency. And if people didn't have the funds, they would get approved, and the vets would cut their prices, and the fund would pay the rest of it. And we saved many, many animals. They're a wonderful, wonderful organization. We also would work with Paws New York, which were, they treat pets of people who are homebound and that can't get care for their pets. So they send people over to pick up the pet and bring the pet to the vet and then bring them back. And it was just such a wonderful organization. So there are different ways to help people out that need that help, for sure.
And you are a recipient of the Veterinary Medical Association for New York, their Distinguished Life Service Award, in part for you are in part for everything you're describing, for finding a way ahead of your time for doing this. But like a lot of things have become more complicated over the years, this has too, I think. And I think we need to find a way. You tell me if you agree. And I don't know what that way is, because I don't also believe that going to a veterinarian should be like going to Tijuana. And I'll say this publicly, I have in front of veterinary audiences, but I'll say it right now. I mean, how many clients come in and go to their doctor, for example, and the doctor says, you need this surgery. And you say, and you probably wouldn't to the doctor, how much is that going to cost? And the doctor in human medicine, it could be for any surgery, like $1 million. And then I'll pay $500,000, but I'm not paying $1 million. I mean, you don't bargain like that with your physician, but we tend to have a history of doing that with veterinarians. I also think that is wrong. I don't think that's fair. But on the other hand, government is not paying, as far as I know, for veterinary care for our pets. And there is pet insurance. There's something called care credit. I mean, there are other things that we can do. Right. There are other things we can do. I think a lot of people don't know about those resources.
Yes. A lot of our clients, unfortunately not as many as should, had pet insurance. And that has been a big help. And it's something I had to discover, too, for myself, because once I became part-time here in Vermont, I'm like, well, gee, I guess I need pet insurance because I don't have my own hospital anymore. But that's really, really important. And then care credit, yes, is something that they have there. You get approved, and then you pay that off over time, like a veterinary charge card. And those we would use with our patients and owners all the time. So there are other ways to help out. But you're right, you know, veterinary medicine is expensive, and with the more advances that we have, you know, costs are going up. As I was mentioning about all the changes, you know, now we have so much specialization, neurologists, ophthalmologists, dermatologists, cardiologists, oncologists, surgeons, you know, everything that we have in human medicine. And they do a great job, but of course, with that comes a price. Being privileged to practice in New York City, we had cardiologists that would come to us to do echoes and ultrasonographers who would come and evaluate abdominal issues and traveling surgeons. So they would bring their expertise to private practice, and doing it that way would actually end up being cheaper for the owners than going to, you know, emergency hospitals. So that was something that we had in New York City, which I loved.
Now, something that you didn't have back in the day, and who would have ever thought about this, is artificial intelligence, all the buzzwords now. How is that being used in veterinary medicine?
Well, they have come out with artificial intelligence for interpreting x-rays and also interpreting cytology, which are slides you make when you take an aspirate of some cells out of a mass on a pet and want to see what it is. So that can turn around the wait time for the results. And it's much faster. But the one thing I just discovered recently at a conference, they had these AI scribe services, and I was very curious about it. So a friend and I went up, and we said, can we try this? And they said, sure. So one of us was playing vet, one of us was playing owner, and, you know, we gave a history, went through our physical exam, verbalizing everything that we're finding, et cetera. And at the end, it summarized it. And it even wrote the exam up in our regular, what we call SOAP format. And, of course, the vets have to look at it and make sure everything is correct. But once it's correct, you just have to copy it and paste it and put into the computerized record, which saves time, makes you more efficient, and the vets can spend more time with the patients and their owners. So, I mean, that's a beautiful thing that's coming, and I'm really, really excited about that.
I mean, think about it. Yeah, think about it. You go to your own doctor or a veterinarian, and they're busy typing away, and you're thinking, they're not paying any attention to me, or I don't really get to have a conversation. So this is huge for that reason. Believe it or not, we only have about a minute left. Tell me about NAVC Gives.
Okay, so NAVC Gives is our philanthropic arm. We want to give back and support people that are doing wonderful, wonderful things. So we support the unsung heroes in the animal world. We launched it in 2024 by awarding it to Pets Peace of Mind, which is an amazing nonprofit, and they take care of people's pets when the owner is under hospice care. They also adopt out the pet in an unfortunate circumstance of the owner passing away. And, I mean, think of that. What a gift. When you're fighting for your life, the last thing you want to worry about is your beloved pet. But if you're into the last minute, I don't want to take up too much time on that, but people, if they know of any unsung heroes, they can go to NAVC.com/gives and nominate them for an award. We do awards throughout the year, and we really want to encourage people to keep doing the wonderful things that they are doing.
You know, forever, the veterinary profession has been said to be one of the most trusted and beloved professions, and it truly is, according to polls, still the case, and you're a great deal of the reason for that, Dr. Haddock. A pleasure to talk to you. Thank you so very much.
Well, thank you. Really appreciate you just being there for the veterinary community and all the animals and their owners in the world. That is so important. You always have a wealth of information. So thank you for being there for all of us.
We are all about microchipping pets, right? I mean, you know what that is. It's the size of a little grain of rice. It's a chip that a veterinarian, animal shelter, anyone with the device that can detect what information is on the chip so the pet who's lost can be returned. However, without that information on the chip, the person whose pet it is, how they can be reached, an email or telephone number, all of that, how do they possibly? It's like having a telephone without a phone number. It doesn't do any good. Well, a microchip provider called Save This Life has apparently gone out of business, and with it, they took all that registration information. So if you were registered from Save This Life, or not sure that you were or not, it's important to find out. Information about that is on my website, stevedale.tv, which will tell you more about what to do next. Steve Dale's Pet World, back with you on WGN. So I do a show also on Sunday afternoons. It's not necessarily, in fact, it's not about pets. I speak with a wide variety of people from 1 o'clock to 3 o'clock. When there's no Blackhawk hockey or other sports activities. And, wow, I get to talk to a variety of showbiz folks, and I talk with public officials, like the mayor, which isn't always a good thing, but nevertheless. And I talk with book authors, including Arwinder Kaur, who wrote a book called Living While Human. And I thought, you know what, this conversation, to be honest, would also be great for the show that I do and have been doing forever about companion animals and what they mean to us. And you told me, Arwinder, a great story about a dog that wasn't a trained cancer detection dog. And we can talk about how dogs are actually being trained to do that now. But this was your pet that not once, but twice, if I recall, detected cancer in a person and once did the same to a dog friend that this dog had. Do I recall correctly?
Exactly. Correctly, yes. He's just a very intelligent dog. What can I say? Yeah. I just happened to luck upon him. He was a rehome. I got him when he was 4 months old. He's a cross between a Havanese and a Maltese.
And just, you know, I had no idea. I had so many dogs over my lifetime, and they're all special. But this one, it was a little off the charts. And he is considered a work dog, that breed. So he definitely has a very keen sense, you know, of smell. But he's also, not only has he detected cancer basically three times, as you point out, but he's also... He copies a lot of stuff I do, believe it or not. Hmm. He trained himself to go to the bathroom in the bathroom. He knows I go in there to do my business. So all of a sudden, he started peeing in the stand-up shower. He goes and pees in the stand-up shower.
All right. Now, like, let me stop you here because this is interesting. I've never heard of this. So yeah. The dog, first of all, are you suggesting that you do the same thing in your shower?
I don't do that in my shower, but he knows I go in the bathroom.
Okay.
He doesn't know how to go in the toilet. So he does the closest thing that he can mimic that I do in there, and he goes in the stand-up shower.
And you're okay with that, clearly.
Well, it's not a big deal. I mean, you know, sure. I mean, if that's what he's, if he's going to do it somewhere, it's better in the bathroom, right? yeah, it's just like a little kid or something. You know, they sometimes they'll pee in there. So now what I do is I just put a towel there in the stand-up shower. So whenever he wants to go, he can take a pee, and then I just do the laundry. You know, but the point is that he'll mimic things that I do. So he'll notice that, you know, sometimes before I go to bed, I'll grab a drink or water or whatever and bring it. So then he notices this. So now he will run and go get one of his little bones or something. And then he'll bring that so that he has his thing that he's got to have to bed with him. The other thing which I found fascinating is he's actually my backup alarm for my alarm system. And what I mean by that is I usually turn my alarm, you know, for stay option. So in the morning, sometimes I forget to disarm it. So when I go to open the balcony door or whatever to let him out, it'll make a special beep, beep, beep. It's letting me know that I forgot to disarm my alarm. Mm-hmm. But I don't actually notice that. How I know that I've not disarmed it is Monty will freeze. He won't move. So in other words, I'll open the door, but he won't go out into the balcony. He will just freeze where he is until I go, oh, my God, yeah. Because I'm like, what are you doing? Why are you moving? Oh, God, yeah, I didn't disarm it. Then I run and I disarm it. Then he goes. Then he moves. And he'll do this every time. If I can walk in and I don't do it, he won't go up the stairs. He just freezes to let me know, and no, you didn't disarm the alarm. This dog, I tell you, he's something else.
But I wonder if, I don't doubt that, but I wonder if more dogs are, and we're just not aware of what they're trying to tell us, which actually ties in with your book, Living, award-winning book, shall I say, Living While Human. Because the book, in great part, there are several messages, but one is about the environment and the animals who share the planet with us, which include companion animals, but not limited to. Do you think that we don't give those variety of animals credit as we should for being as smart as they are for what they need to do every day, no matter what the species is?
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. I mean, we're not just, as you say, we're not just talking about domesticated animals. We're talking about every species. I mean, humans are the only ones that have to go to school to learn anything. You know, even the most basic things. Let's face it, a spider building a spider web is very complex geometry. We don't know geometry. We have to go to school, and even then, most of us can't learn it. But a spider knows how to make a geometric perfect design. It's engineering marvel. And when you think about all the animals, like when there's going to be a tsunami, well, first thing animals do is they go to higher ground. That's what they noticed when there was the big tsunami in the Indonesia and Sri Lanka, that huge one. All the animals had gone to higher ground. And earthquakes, weather patterns, all of these things, animals know. You know, they know when to fly south. They know when to, you know, so they have all of that knowledge and intelligence. It is intelligence. We just say if humans do it, it's intelligence. If animals do it, oh, it's instinct. But think about camouflage, the whole idea that an animal can replicate, camouflage itself so that it's indistinguishable from its surroundings, whether it's a leaf, a bark, a rock, snow, whatever the case is, it can actually change itself to mimic exactly its surroundings.
Now,
that's pretty incredible.
It is. With a chameleon, for example, I don't know that there's thought process involved with that. However, we now know with an octopus, for example, that there actually is thought process as to what is going to work in this particular situation to better illustrate what my emotion is, as well as, in many cases, just blending in with the environment.
Absolutely. I mean, this is the thing, just because, like I say in my book, you know, we only can measure intelligence from our own point of view. So if, for example, if Einstein had been completely incapable of communicating in any form whatsoever, couldn't move his eyes, couldn't move his limbs, he would have still had that intelligent genius brain, but we would have just thought he was an imbecile. Or perhaps, you know, not mentally very sharp at all because he's not able to communicate with us. But that doesn't mean that there isn't an intelligent brain in there. It's just that it's not the language that we speak. But they're communicating, you know, amongst each other all the time. And they're passing on, most importantly, they're passing on survival instincts and knowledge to the next generation, to its offspring, which is the purpose of having offspring, of having the next generation. So it's all the other species are capable of doing this very seamlessly. And they're also very capable of living very sustainably without having to do, so-called recycling, reducing and reusing and all of these things we think we're so clever at coming up with. Animals are nature's been doing it since day one.
And that's where I want That's where I want to pick up this conversation with our Winder Core. The name of the book is called Living While Human. We will do that on WGN. This great lady is our Winder Core, who is the author of Living While Human. What motivated you, Arwinder, to write this book in the first place, that I need to say this and then receive all these awards for saying it?
Right. Well, I mean, I've always been a very passionate person in terms of my principles and, you know, things about social justice, animal welfare, you know, atrocities. All of these things are things that I cannot just sort of look the other way. I have to do something about it, whatever I can. And so I have been compiling a bunch of my own sort of axioms or maxims, whatever you want to, philosophical sayings, my compass for how to live as a human being. So that I had been sort of slowly compiling over the, you know, many decades. And I was going to publish that. And then I thought, well, you know, I was encouraged to elaborate more about myself and my own history and my past. So it became more autobiographical, though I had not had that intention in the beginning. So, and also what really got my sort of life focused on environmental issues was the book Ishmael by Daniel Quinn. I always mention him because he's been an absolute pivotal mentor in my life. Fortunately, he's passed away now, but that book basically changed my life. And also very famous in the sense that it won a very prestigious award, the Ted Turner Fellowship Award. And so that really, I had all these things going on and I needed to put it somewhere. So I think when a lot of other people during COVID, I just started sort of focusing on, well, maybe I'll just actually try and get this done. Let's see, how do I publish this? And so it just became a sort of a manuscript in progress and ended up with what I ended up with, the final result. And, yeah, surprising to me more than anyone was that it won anything, let alone multiple awards. I'm very grateful for that. I think what it is, it's resonating with people, the message, the time, and perhaps maybe a fresh new perspective on how to look at things and also how to address some of the problems.
Well, you go so far as to say we are, as a species, committing suicide. I think those are Winder, are your exact words.
Yeah, sure, absolutely. I mean, it's that's, I don't think it's in question. I mean, people don't see it that way. But if you look at the fact that we are the only species who is actually not giving our offspring the tools that they need to survive in a sustainable world, we're handing them a planet. It's just like, say, a parent. I mean, as a parent, would you leave in your will for your children a home that was completely toxic, that was just going to, you know, poison them overnight, and knowingly do that to your children? But that's what we're doing. And none of us are sort of really getting to the point where we're reacting in a way that would be appropriate for what the circumstances are. And we're in a crisis. But this is too overwhelming for people to understand and to do something about personally. They feel overwhelmed by it. So we have a tendency of, you know, kind of disassociating from it and hoping that it's not going to be bad. It's going to be better than it is. But, you know, we are, when you think about, you know, the planet can only, as you pointed out before, the whole issue of DDT, I mean, we've been living for decades poisoning every ecological system there is. The air, I mean, you know, we get to warnings all the time saying, you know, as an advisory, don't go outside. Don't, you know, stay indoors if you have respiratory problems. Don't drink this water. There's a drinking water advisory. You know, there's all of these, you know, there's prenatal issues going on where, you know, our hormones are changing because of the massive use of plastics, particularly, you know, microwaving and so forth. Those are what's called xenoestrogens, which are called hormone-mimicking chemicals, which are leaching into us all the time. And that's actually created hormonal changes. And there is notable differences that are going on in terms of the reproductive systems. In fact, even things like fertility rates and industrialized societies have steadily taken a dive. So nature is trying to tell us all the time that there's something wrong, and these are the things that we're doing to ourselves because we are ingesting all these things, and it's in all of our bloodstreams. We all have microplastics in us, and every species on this planet has.
Yeah, today. Yeah.
Yeah.
So here's my question for you. So right now, we might have even lost some people who's, I'm not going to listen to this, you know, and mm-hmm. and there are, that's half the people or whatever that number is. And then there's the other group that are aware of everything you're talking about. But what about that other group that are never going to pick up your book? Don't even want to hear you and I talk about this.
Yeah.
Don't somehow, some way believe that it's happening. Lost faith in science somehow.
Yeah.
Facts no longer seem to matter. How do you reach those people?
You know, and I'm not sure that we can. I think that the most we can do is try and reach people who are open enough to say, hey, this makes sense. Like, maybe we should question things. That's part of our evolutionary process, is to develop and to grow as humans. And we can't just sort of put our heads in the sand, and think that, okay, everything's going to just be fine. And you know what? There is a comforting part that I always have to tell myself. Nature ultimately is more powerful than any one species, and it will survive in whatever capacity that it does. But that doesn't mean that there's not going to be ecological consequences, which there already are, in terms of we are a biological species. For those who don't believe in what I'm saying, there's very little DNA difference between us and, for example, the apes. Maybe you're not going to believe that. But in terms of our biology, we can tell that all species on this earth are all connected. And we all live on the same elements of air, water, and sun, and so forth. So, and I think I pointed out last time, people don't believe in, well, that's like saying you don't believe in gravity. Well, I don't believe there's such a thing as gravity, so if I jump off a plane, I should be fine. But you know what's going to happen. There is gravity, and people are going to fall to the ground and crash. So you don't have to believe in gravity, but that doesn't mean that you're not going to be subject to its consequences if you don't believe it. all I can say.
Yeah. The name of the book, again, is Living While Human. It's an important read, I think, and clearly those who judge books think it's a very good read. Our Winder Corps, thank you once again for joining us. And you are absolutely right about one thing for sure. Anyone who has ever seen me eat knows that we're, at least I'm only one genetic point away from a chimpanzee because it's very, very similar.
Yep.
Thank you, R. Winder. Heart Disease in Cats, a killer of so many cats. It is a more common cause of death. It's called feline hypertrophic cardiomyopathy in cats than heart disease is in people. That's how common this is in cats. And now we have, this is incredible, a treatment that is going to work. There is information about this both on my website, stevedale.tv, or check out everycat.org. There's a symposium that'll describe everything that's coming up at North Carolina State University College of Veterinary Medicine, but you don't need to go there. You can attend virtually. Next week on the show, I am so excited. Remember the TV show Laughing? Joanne Worley will be here. She is currently the president of Actors and Others for Animals, and I'm going to try to get her to laugh. Her laugh is the best laugh in showbiz still. We'll talk to you next week, bright and early, on WGN.